are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 14th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ari Berman on Kris Kobach's plan to preserve white power and rig GOP election wins. Meanwhile, five shot in D.C. at a Republican congressional baseball practice. The shooter has died. And one of those shot was Congressman Steve Scalise. Also on the program today, Trump apparently finds out what's inside the health care bill. Says it's mean. 200 Democratic lawmakers file an emolument suit against the president. In Virginia, Tom Perriello loses to the establishment candidate Northam, who wins big in the Virginia Democratic governor primary. Also in Virginia, Democrats nominated in the primary a woman who would be the first transgender lawmaker in the state. Also on the program today, Jeff Sessions, super evasive in his Intel hearing testimony. And had to withstand being questioned by Kamala Harris. Particularly difficult for him. Meanwhile, NBC holding crisis meetings over Megyn Kelly. Caveat emptor. The head of the Michigan Health Department has been charged with manslaughter over the Legionnaires' disease that was also part of the Flint, Michigan water crisis. And lastly, your July online porn viewing may be briefly interrupted. All that and more on today's program. But first, let's get to this. Go ahead, Kelly.
It is my great and wonderful mom's birthday.
She shares a birthday with our president.
We discussed that. So it's the best person's birthday and worst person
ever. There you
go.
Well, I had a friend of mine, Eric Sloven, who is the executive director of the, what's that that show on Comedy Central? It's not Two Broke Girls. What's it? Broad City. His birthday was on 9/11. So
I had some friends get married on 9/11 intentionally because it's really cheap. I know. Divorced now, but...
Well, there you go.
Anyway, happy birthday, Mom. You're a great mom.
I don't know. I feel like if you can get together and you and your husband or wife-to-be, and you can both come to the conclusion that it's worth it to save money to get married on 9/11, I feel like I'm surprised that didn't work out, to be honest with you. All right. Let's obviously get to the breaking news. Pretty disturbing, and also a good example of why we should have probably stricter gun laws in this country. This morning, apparently the There is the House, lawmakers in general, I guess it is, Senate and both the House, I believe, have a baseball league or softball league. I'm not exactly sure. This morning, a gunman approached the baseball field in Alexandria, Virginia, as members of Congress, all Republicans, held a morning baseball practice. A man who's been identified as James T. Hodgkinson III from Illinois was killed in a shootout with police. Two of the police were wounded. The other three who were wounded included House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. Steve Scalise, of course, has been, he's the, like I say, the majority whip, and introduced H.R. 58, the Firearms Interstate Commerce Reform Act, which improves the ability of law-abiding citizens, like a man named James T. Hodgkin, ability to purchase firearms, just coincidentally. Apparently, Hodgkins is was vehemently anti-Trump and had a Facebook post that said, "Trump is a traitor. He's destroyed our democracy. It's time to destroy Trump and company." It appears that the other two people who were shot, in addition to Scalise and the police officers, one was a legislative correspondent for Representative Roger Williams, expected to make a full recovery. Matt Mika, a lobbyist for Tyson Foods, was taken to a local hospital, is in unknown condition. The two officers have not suffered any life-threatening injuries. So, as far as we can tell, the good news is that none of the victims are in a life-threatening situation, although we don't know the status of one of them. We don't know much about the shooter beside what I've just told you at this point, and I would even caution very often with these things, you don't get the right information early on, although, you know, this is, the FBI is on top of this, obviously, very, very quickly. Here is Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia just giving his update. We should say that he misstates how many people are killed in gun violence every day. It's not 93 million. It is 93 people. 93 million, of course, would be, that would be, well, we wouldn't be around to the end of the week to talk about. But here's McAuliffe.
Well, let me say this. I think we need to do more to protect all of our citizens. I have long advocated, this is not what today is about, but there are too many guns on the street. We lose 93 million Americans a day to gun violence. I mean, I've long talked about this. Background checks, shutting down gun show loopholes. You know, that's not for today's discussion, but it's not just about politicians. We worry about this every day for all of our citizens.
If it's not the day for it, why are you bringing it up? People are going to criticize that you're bringing up gun control at this time.
Well, I'm talking about this every single day. This is a very serious issue.
You know, I think it's a pretty good day to bring it up. And I don't know. There was actually a hearing scheduled on the Hill today to expand gun rights. It was canceled. But it'll be interesting. I have a feeling Steve Scalise will stay even more determined on expanding gun rights for people. I guess theoretically, if they were all packing heat, I don't know what would have happened. I mean, there were cops there.
Make it tough to run the bases.
Yeah. There were cops there already. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Ari Berman about Kris Kobach. One of, I think, the most creepy people involved in our government and one of the most anti-democratic. I think really, no, he's up there. I'm going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ari Berman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the best-selling author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, writer at The Nation magazine, on his most recent piece in The New York magazine, New York Times magazine, Ari Berman.
Hey, Sam.
How are you,
New York Times magazine. I don't want New York magazine to get mad at me for pretending that I write for them.
No, I understand. The New York Times magazine, and you've written, and you obviously are a voting rights expert in this country, and you have written about Kris Kobach, who, I mean, I sort of knew a little bit about him before I read your piece, but after reading your piece, I sort of feel he might be one of the creepiest people who are in our national politics right now. I mean, you know, like a guy like Jeff Sessions, he's a liar. He may be a little bit corrupt, and he's a horrible, racist. But he's sort of one-dimensional in that way. Kris Kobach seems to be multi-dimensional in his creepy and horrificness.
Well, I think what I wanted people to understand is he really is the architect of Trumpism, to the extent that there is any ideology behind Donald Trump. He is the guy who has promulgated these things. So the idea, you know, that when Trump came out and said, you know, Mexicans are rapists and murderers and we're going to build a wall and do all of those things, Kobach was the guy who, before Trump ever came on the scene, was trying to restrict immigration. And when Trump said that 3 to 5 million people had voted illegally, Kobach was the guy who was in his ear saying that voter fraud by non-citizens was rampant, even though there was no evidence of any of this kind of stuff. So I really wanted to talk about this intellectual movement that has come behind the president that to restrict voting, to restrict immigration, to try to preserve a shrinking white majority and say, you know, there are real people behind this. It's easy to sort of dismiss Trump, but there are real people behind this that have spent a lot of time getting to this position where someone like Donald Trump could be elected president, where we could have these kind of restrictive policies put in place. And even though Chris Kobach is just a Secretary of State, he's enormously powerful in that position, and his influence really can be seen all over the place, but particularly in the Trump era.
You know, it's fascinating because, you know, it's as if Trump basically takes the top line, right? And you have laid out all of the infrastructure, all of the scaffolding, all of the floors beneath the sort of the penthouse that Donald Trump adopted when he came down the escalator stairs. And when you read this stuff about Kobach, it reminded me of a caller that we had very early on who was an adamant Trump supporter, and his biggest issue was this whole notion that, and this is back in, you know, July of 2015, his biggest issue was the idea that there were millions of immigrants, of undocumented immigrants who were voting in elections, local elections, national elections. And this was his animating point. And really, to a large extent, there's really not a lot else about sort of Trumpism that has been, that still remains intact, right? I mean, when we talk about all of the things that Trump had sort of implied that he was interested in and promised, none of it withstood even the slightest bit of I guess, sausage making in Washington, except for the anti-immigrant and the sort of, I guess, this through line that, you know, there's a lot of illegal people voting. So let's start with Birthlink. What is Birthlink?
Well, I think, okay, that's a little obscure. I think we should start with the fact, you know, Kansas passed this law to require proof of citizenship to vote. So basically, you know, well before Trump had started talking about, you know, millions of people voting illegally, this was something that Chris Kobach, who was Secretary of State of Kansas, was talking about very aggressively. He said that a registration by aliens was pervasive and that Kansas needed to pass a law requiring proof of citizenship for voter registration to combat this. And now proof of citizenship for voter registration means you have to show in Kansas a birth certificate, a passport, or naturalization papers to be able to register to vote. Well, the problem in Kansas and in elsewhere is that people don't carry those documents on them. This isn't like voter ID, where you have to show a driver's license to register, and 90% of people have a driver's license. This is more specific documentation. Most people don't carry a passport around with them. Most people don't have a passport. Only 7% of Americans even have a passport. Most people don't know where their birth certificates are. Most people don't know where their naturalization papers are. And then to have to bring them with them when they register to vote is really burdensome. So what we've seen in Kansas is that 1 in 7 people who tried to register to vote after 2013 when this law into effect were blocked from registering, which is just an enormous number. I mean, imagine if you have 7 people in line to register to vote and 1 out of 7 of them can't register. That's what's happened in Kansas. So what I tried to show in this piece was both, A, the lack of evidence that's presented to justify claims of voter fraud, but number 2, the ramifications of policies to make it harder to vote. Because the whole reason that politicians like Chris Kobach and Donald Trump talk about voter fraud is because they want to put in place policies like these policies, proof of citizenship, which in the case of Kansas basically froze the electorate because they made it so hard to register voters that you had a situation where tens of thousands of people were blocked from registering. And because they were people that were registering for the first time, they were disproportionately younger. They were disproportionately less likely to be Republicans. They were more likely to be lower income or people of color. So it froze the Republican electorate in place in that state.
And I think even just, you know, look, you got to pay an extra $40 to get the birth certificate. You got to pay X or Y for a passport. And if you're not traveling out of the country, you wouldn't get that. So you right there, you're already, and, you know, the idea that you would sort of like, okay, I'm going to go register to vote, but I need a month or 3 weeks or 2 weeks lag time to go and petition the hospital to get a copy of my birth certificate, et cetera, et cetera. This, I think you could probably rather easily also say that it disproportionately hits people living in poverty as well. Let's start with sort of Kris Kobach's, I guess, intellectual development, starting at the Harvard Center for International Affairs. I mean, did Kobach go to Harvard? Is that what? How did he get under? How did he become a protege of Professor Samuel Huntington? And who is Huntington?
So this was interesting because, you know, Kobach has degrees from Harvard, Oxford, and Yale. So he's obviously a very smart guy. And one thing I wondered is, you know, how could a guy who has all these degrees from very liberal institutions be so conservative, particularly on issues like immigration, when he was a pretty worldly guy who was clearly exposed to other cultures? And one thing I realized is that when he went to Harvard as an undergrad, he was a protege of a very well-known professor, Samuel Huntington, who had very, very extreme views when it came to race. Huntington worked in the National Security Council under Jimmy Carter, but he wasn't really a Democrat, or if he was, he was a very old school Democrat. He pioneered this idea of a clash of civilizations between Islam in the West, and that book became very, very famous. But then he wrote this book in 2004 called Who Are We? That was about immigration. And he said a lot of really alarming things. He denounced what he called the Hispanicization of the U.S. He said that Mexican Americans were contemptuous of American culture, that they didn't identify with the United States, all of these really anti-immigrant, anti-Latino things. And then, you know, I went back and looked at some of his writing from the 1970s and the 1980s, and I realized that Huntington had advised apartheid South African government, that he had written this article for the Trilateral Commission that talked about how the U.S. had too much democracy, that if you extended democracy, in his words, to the blacks, it would overwhelm the political system. And this was Kris Kobach's lead advisor at Harvard. And it struck me that, granted, you know, that this was only when Kobach was an undergrad, but so much of what Huntington was talking about over the years from the 1970s onwards seems to have shaped Kobach's views both on immigration and on this view that, you know, maybe broad-based democracy isn't so great of a thing.
I just want to say, kudos to Harvard for having such an open mind about their faculty who introduced this idea that you don't want to give too much power to the blacks when they vote. It was interesting that he also, I mean, because Kobach and I are pretty close to the same age, and the idea of him fighting the divestiture movement from South Africa and sort of towing the Reagan, I guess, line of constructive engagement as they Reagan was pushing is interesting. There's
Kobach wrote his senior thesis saying that universities like Harvard shouldn't divest from South Africa because international businesses were leading the way against apartheid, which struck me as a very revisionist history of the fight against apartheid. I mean, maybe some international businesses were against apartheid, but they certainly weren't leading a global movement to get rid of a white supremacist state. And the fact that he was writing this as an undergrad, I mean, as an undergrad, you know, you're supposed to be idealistic, you're supposed to be against things like apartheid. And at the same time, you know, Kobach is taking the side of business against universities. And his advisor, Samuel Huntington, is actually advising South Africa's apartheid government, saying that maybe they need a form of enlightened despotism, whatever that means. I guess maybe that's like what Putin's Russia is today.
Right. And I mean, if I recall correctly, businesses weren't leading the fight against apartheid. There were some businesses who were hiring black South Africans. And that was basically it. I mean, maybe there was a couple, but you're right. And I don't know. This is another instance of like Ronald Reagan, being the equivalent of that that kidney death punch, right? Where you don't die for 3 weeks after you've been punched in the kidney. I mean, Reagan just sort of spawned a generation of people around my age who are still hurting this country, in my estimation. So this idea of Huntington's that became a sort of, it seems to be like Kobach's worldview, which has not changed, which is that there is almost a moral imperative to prevent people other than white people from voting in this country. Is that fair?
What I really wanted to show in the article was that there's all of these phrases that are used, whether it's they're talking about voter fraud or they're talking about illegal immigrants, and then they make it just, and he just talks about the rule of law, that he's just restoring the rule of law back to the United States. But what I thought was really important to show is that basically they're trying to create a society that's A, more Republican, but B, literally trying to create a society that's more white, to reduce both the size of and influence of the country's non-white population. Kobach has said, for example, that one of the reasons he opposes immigration reform is because he believes that if 11 million undocumented immigrants are given citizenship, they will vote Democratic, and it will be, in his words, a locked-in vote for socialism. And we also just look at the fact that all of these claims about non-citizen voting are laying the groundwork for policies that create both a more Republican and more white electorate. But also, if you talk about illegal aliens voting, as he does over and over and over, that's also going to build support for a policy of deportation, to actually forcibly remove people from the United States. And so I think, you know, multiple things are going on here when they're talking about this. And I think the ramifications for the country are really disturbing. And I think often, you know, people don't call this stuff out for what it is. People don't want to talk about the racist overtones. They don't want to talk about the white nationalism. They don't want to talk about the white supremacy inherent in these views. And this was all something that we decided to deal with head on in our article, because we thought we had to be really, really honest about what's actually happening here.
Yeah, I mean, you make that point, and I'm trying to find where that line is, where you do specifically say, like, there's, you have a notion. I mean, for instance, you know, we can see this in North Carolina, where African Americans are targeted to be disenfranchised, largely to help, almost exclusively, I guess, largely to help the Republicans win. But with Kobach, it does feel like the ends and the means are sometimes fluid. They switch back and forth. We want things to be more Republican because it'll make things more white, ultimately. I mean, we're seeing this now. Not only are we seeing increased deportations, we're seeing the type of deportations in terms of, like, the people who are being picked up is changing, right? It's not no longer gang members.
It's really alarming. I mean, I just saw a story today about someone who was picked up right before his high school graduation. And, you know, I asked Kobach about this because I interviewed him, and some of the stuff didn't make it into the final piece because the story was 7,000 words long. We couldn't include everything. But, you know, I asked him about this because, you know, the day I interviewed him, there had been a story about a woman in Mississippi who was a valedictorian, and they were going to deport her. She was a dreamer. And I said, why are we deporting people that are doing really well, that are graduating at the top of their classes, that are going to get good jobs, that are going to pay good taxes, they're going to be contributing all of these things for America? Why would we want those people to leave our country? And he said, well, you know, if they've been here illegally, they've essentially been stealing American services, and we've allowed them to stay, and now they need to leave. And this idea that we can just take 11 million people and deport them is so astounding. I mean, I learned a lot about immigration in reporting this article, and one thing I learned is that two-thirds of the undocumented population have been here for more than 10 years or longer. So these are people that, for all intents and purposes, are Americans. They're part of American society. They're working. They're paying taxes. They're doing jobs, in many cases, that other people won't do. And if we were to implement a policy that would deport 11 million people, it would be so catastrophic to our economy, but it would be so morally catastrophic even more. This idea that we would just rip communities apart because someone came here illegally 99% of the time because they wanted to build a better life for themselves. So I just find the cruelty behind this to be so staggering, and I just couldn't believe it, because I mean, when I interviewed Kobach, I mean, he's a perfectly nice guy, but it's just one of those things, like, how could a guy who's, you know, perfectly nice guy then turn around and say, you know, I want to kick valedictorians of college out of the country? It's pretty remarkable that someone would get to that point.
It also, it's interesting to me, this concept that they're stealing, because it would imply that, you know, if someone with a job, right, who's paying their taxes, is stealing from America, it would suggest that it lends some credence to the theory of you didn't build that, right? I mean, they're obviously getting some value, societal value, that is not tied to benefits, that is like the average, you know, the middle class, maybe even wealthy in some instances, person is getting value just by being in America, that it's helping them in some fashion. I don't know. That's probably
Well, the thing is the most vulnerable members of society have been scapegoated. You know, so, you know, jobs will go overseas, and Donald Trump will tell people, you know, it's the Mexicans
right.
that stole them, which is instead of, you know, blaming the corporations that have done these things, you're blaming the workers that are here. And, you know, when Kobach's policies have been put into place, when states like Alabama, for example, severely restricted immigration, there just weren't enough jobs. There weren't enough workers to do the jobs. There weren't enough people to farm. There weren't enough people to do the routine jobs that many undocumented immigrants are doing, that many Americans, for one reason or another, just won't do that kind of work. It's too difficult. It's too taxing. So to me, it seems like a supply and demand issue, that there's clearly a demand for a lot of this work, and that's why people are coming. And if there wasn't a demand, they wouldn't come. But they're not stealing American jobs. They're doing jobs that Americans have decided they don't want to do anymore. Quote unquote, Americans don't want to do anymore. So that's why I think a lot of the effort to combat undocumented immigration isn't really about immigration. It's about preserving America's white majority instead. And if you look deeper at all the people that have built the intellectual case for restricting immigration, it's all people that were worried about the fate of the country's white European Anglo-Saxon majority. That's always what's been one level beneath this, is always a worry about what's happening to the fate of the white race. And that's what I think is motivating all of this, not the economy or jobs or anything like that.
I think there's significant data to show that. But what's interesting about Kobach in that context is he, it seems to me, and you would have a better sense of this because you have tracked the attempts to suppress the vote, and the successful attempts, I should say, in many respects, to suppress the vote, particularly of minorities around the country. But, I mean, would you say that Kobach is distinct? I mean, did it change your perspective in looking at Kobach as to the motivation behind this? that whether it's Republican, you know, I want a Republican majority, or simply a Republican majority also happens to be a means to having this more America for white Americans only type of situation.
I think Kobach has many more ties to white nationalists and white supremacists than many other people in the Republican Party. So I think there are some Republicans that are perfectly reasonable people that just want to suppress the vote because they think it'll benefit them politically. I think that that's very problematic that they want to do that. But I don't necessarily think that they are racist. I think there are other people that want to suppress the vote and want to restrict immigration and do things like that, both because they think it's going to benefit the Republican Party, but also because race is a serious part of this. And I think if you just look at Kobach's career, the people that he's chosen to associate himself, whether it was Samuel Huntington at Harvard or whether it was groups like FAIR, the anti-immigration group, that race has always been a big part of these kind of efforts. And, you know, and they'll deny it. You know, Kobach denied it. These groups will deny it. But if you look at the work they've done and the statements of their founders and the purpose of these organizations was to preserve the country's white majority. And I think we really have to be open about that, because I think it gets to this broader debate about why people voted for Trump and what Trump represents. And I think, you know, a big part of why people voted for Trump and what Trump represents is the fact that people wanted to preserve the country's white majority after the election of the first black president. That's what Make America Great Again was all about. And I think, you know, Kobach is really one of those people that is appealing to that idea that, you know, when he talks about Make America Great Again, it's very much a throwback to a time when we didn't have the demographics and the immigration that we do now.
And we should say, you know, there's increasingly more data to support that. There was a study that just came out the other day by the Voter Study Group, which comprises of 20 conservative, progressive, and independent academics and professional survey researchers. And they released a trove of polling that dates the data that tracks American views back to December 2011. John Sides is involved in this. And it's even the Obama to Trump voters were motivated by their views on immigration, blacks, and Muslims. And then, by a lesser extent, their views of the economy and their own financial circumstances. So, you know, it flies in the face of what you, you know, what you would assume, you know, that someone who is racist wouldn't vote for a black guy. But I think, you know, racism is on a continuum, and there are certain circumstances where it's like, I'll vote for the black guy. But, you know, I've had enough. Trump has got a point about the brown people. But let's stick with Kobach for a moment here, because what also struck me in your piece is that Kobach seems to sort of have a history of being brought in as almost like one of those, like, McKinsey consultants for different racist and suppressive projects around the country. Like, he's friends with Arpaio and goes into Arizona to help with SB 1070. I mean, he's brought in like sort of like, hey, we need to do something really racist and oppressive. Get Kobach here.
No, yeah, I mean, that is a really good way of putting it that I hadn't thought about. I mean, he really was. I mean, before he was the kind of McKinsey of voter suppression, he was the McKinsey of restricting immigration, and nowhere was this clearer than in Arizona. And you know, there was so much shady stuff happening in Arizona in the mid 2000s, where you had a whole breed of politicians like Sheriff Joe Arpaio, like Russell Pierce, who was a state legislator there, like the Maricopa County attorney. And basically they all rose to fame by combating undocumented immigration. This is how they all took office. This is how they all became famous. I mean, Sheriff Joe was the most notorious guy because he was the one who had, you know, the prisons where people wore pink underwear and they worked on chain gangs and they lived in tents where it was 130 degrees. And this was humiliating and degrading and ultimately illegal. But it made, you know, Sheriff Joe famous, and it made these politicians famous because they were playing to people's nativism and playing to people's xenophobia. But Kobuk was the guy who gave them this authority, who made up all of these legal theories that had no basis in actual fact, but said, you know, you have the inherent authority to enforce immigration law, even though the federal government, not states and localities, had the power to enforce immigration law. Or he told them that they should do what was called attrition through enforcement, that they should make life so miserable for immigrants that they'd eventually just leave on their own. This is what Mitt Romney called a self-deportation. But so Kobuk's peddling all of these crazy theories, which leads to SB 1070, the Arizona law, which is the papers please law, where they can stop anybody that they deem to not be in the United States illegally. And what's interesting about this is it's basically a disaster for Arizona. You know, Sheriff Joe Arpaio got voted out of office in 2016. He was sued by the Justice Department for racial profiling. He was held in contempt of court. Russell Pierce, who wrote SB 1070, that he was recalled from office. The county attorney in Maricopa County in Phoenix who hired Kobuk was disbarred by the state Supreme Court. So all of these guys in Arizona are ending up in disgrace, except for Kobuk. He's the guy who somehow emerges from this entire thing unscathed, and not just unscathed, but he goes on to become Secretary of State of Kansas, largely because of the reputation he's built for combating illegal immigration. So I just found this to be such a fascinating case study in an experiment that went completely badly, but the guy who actually conducted the experiment somehow made it out unscathed.
And but he's not terribly popular in Kansas, is he?
No. Well, it's going to be interesting. He's running for governor of Kansas now. And Kansas is at an interesting inflection point. Obviously, Sam Brownback, the governor there, is very, very unpopular. He passed the most radical tax reductions in the country, basically starved the state. He did exactly what Grover Norquist wanted to do, where he said, you know, shrink government so small you can drown it in a bathtub.
Literally brought in Arthur Laffer. Like literally, like not metaphorically imposed the Laffer curve, but literally
exactly.
Paid Arthur Laffer to come in and consult him on how to do it.
And so they did all of the stuff that Republicans for years have been trying to do in any state, basically.
He advertised it as the greatest experiment. And in 2012, when they passed this, he said, we finally have the opportunity to do a genuine experiment on this.
Yeah.
And 6 years later, 5 years later, the state has had horrible cuts, has had a tremendous amount of lack of revenue. And in fact, the state legislature, both Republican and Democrats, voted to override his veto to raise taxes again.
Yeah. So, you know, that's pretty remarkable. I mean, you had, you know, a Republican legislature vote with a supermajority to end the signature achievement of the Republican governor. So Brownback is very unpopular. Brownback's agenda is very unpopular. But what's interesting is Kobuk announced for governor and immediately criticized the legislature's tax plan. So he sided with Brownback on taxes, which is the most unpopular thing that Brownback has done. So, I mean, the positioning that he's doing is quite strange. Also, Kansas hasn't adopted any of his anti-immigration policies. Kansas is very reliant on farm workers. They don't want an Arizona-type situation there where they can't have labor, where people are deported. Kobuk actually called Kansas the sanctuary state of the Midwest. I'm not sure if Kansans are going to really like that designation. So he's emerging as governor on the far right flank of the party. That says he has enormous name recognition. He'll have a national fundraising base because of his Trump links. And he's going to do a lot of the Trump-like politics that we saw during the primary. And everyone said it wasn't going to work for Trump and ultimately was successful for him. So I'm not counting Kobuk out. Kansas is a very conservative state. I think if he was to become governor, it would be incredibly dangerous. Right now, he's just Secretary of State. So imagine the power he would have as governor. I also think it would set him up for a presidential run, because he can be the guy who said, even if Trump becomes unpopular, he can be the guy who said, you know, I was the intellectual foundation.
Right.
For Trumpism, which I believe will remain popular within Republican circles, even if Trump himself is disgraced.
Just tell us briefly about this interstate voter registration cross-check program. Because cross-check was, by some, credited with disenfranchising enough voters in certainly in Wisconsin and Michigan to flip those states, maybe in Pennsylvania. But tell us about that.
So I looked into the cross-check program, and basically what it does is it compares potential double voting among states. It's run out of Kansas, but it includes more than 30 states now. And it uses very, very rudimentary data. So you're only looking for someone's first name, their last name, and their date of birth. And that creates a lot of false matches. So a John Smith in Kansas can easily be confused with a John Smith in Iowa. And this happens all the time. And what's happened is when states use cross-check, they get these huge lists of people that are potential double voters. But when they narrow it down using more specific criteria, like people's social security numbers, for example, which aren't included in the cross-check searches, they found very, very, very few cases of double voting. Because, you know, most people, it's hard enough getting people to vote in one place in this country, let alone voting in multiple states. But I didn't see any evidence that people were purged in states like Wisconsin and Michigan in 2016. I saw the potential for a lot of people to be purged by this program, but I asked these states how they're using the cross-check data, and all of these states told me that they are only checking the cross-check data with more detailed information before they purge people from the rolls. But if they didn't do those secondary checks, if they didn't contact voters, if they didn't use more sophisticated information, lots of people can be purged from the voting roll. So I think that cross-check is very problematic. I also think there's some stuff circulating out there about it that's not true. And I think it's important to stick to the facts when it comes to this and other parts of voting rights.
Is there any other, Kobach has really attempted to go after, whether it's the SAFE Act, he is just working overtime to try and find some evidence of like systemic or even not even systemic, but pervasive voter fraud, and has been unable to really do that. I mean, that's what
so he's been told. He's been totally unable to do that. I mean, he's the only Secretary of State in the country with the power to prosecute voter fraud cases. So he's literally the only Secretary of State that has been turned into essentially a prosecutor and instead of an election official. And he's only found one non-citizen who's voted illegally. That's because it doesn't make any sense why a non-citizen would vote and risk deportation. I mean,
some of those comptroller races, Ari, are so significant that, yes, you're willing to get deported to go in and cast your ballot for the comptroller that you really want to win.
I mean, nobody, not Kobach, not anybody, has ever made a convincing case to me why a non-citizen would knowingly vote. Sometimes it happens that people don't understand the rules. They might be green card holders. They might have documents, right? They might have a driver's license. They might have documents, and they're asked, do you want to register to vote? They might even be asked, do you want to vote? And maybe they will, but almost never knowingly do so. You're never going to find dozens and dozens of cases of this knowingly occurring, let alone 3 to 5 million, but they're certainly working overtime trying to make it seem like it's true.
And two points. One is people should also just sort of carry that scenario out. Like, what is the impetus for someone who mistakenly votes, right? Is it, I think it's worth it for me to go in and sway this election? Or is it a deep, abiding, affection for the country and a feeling like I should participate, right? Like, it's not like I'm gonna get the candidate of my choice and that's going to help me in some fashion. Like, I'm going to vote for the local treasurer who's going to make my life considerably better. Or it's like, I love this country so much, I am going to participate in it as a involved in its like citizen engagement. And then I would also say the flip side of that is Kris Kobach has every single incentive in the world, both politically, ideologically, it sounds like philosophically, to go out there and find cases that support what seems to be his lifelong goal, and cannot do it. He has the tools and he cannot do it.
He can't do it, but he keeps failing upwards. So now there's a presidential commission on election integrity that Trump started, and this Kobach is the vice chair of this. And now he's going to have access to all of these new resources that he didn't have before that the federal government has. He's going to take these databases that are not meant to be used to try to match non-citizen voting. But he's going to try to do this, and he's going to say, we have all this new information of thousands of non-citizens who could be registered to vote, which is going to be totally inaccurate information. But nobody's going to read the second part of the story. What I've learned from covering this issue for the last now 7 years is that if you just say something enough times, people will start to believe it. And if you say, you know, voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud enough times, people will start to believe it's real, even if it's not. And so people see the headline. I hope as many people as possible will read the 7,000-word article I wrote. Clearly, a lot of people are reading it, but not as many people are going to read about it as people see Donald Trump's tweets that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally. And so that's the problem we're dealing with, is that there seems to be no penalty for politicians lying about this, because we're in an era now of what Kellyanne Conway called alternative facts, and Kobach is the perfect politician for the alternative facts era.
Let me just ask you one final question, which may be outside of your portfolio, but how much there was a report, and part of this is coming from this leaked NSA document that states that there is a belief by the NSA that the Russians accessed voter data files in one form or another in 39 states across the country. Like I say, this might be outside of your portfolio, but how serious should we take? How serious is that revelation? How founded is it?
Well, I mean, there's no evidence that any votes were actually changed, but it's incredibly serious. And we don't ultimately know that no votes were changed either. I mean, I think, to me, you know, this is what the congressional committees should be looking at, as opposed to trying to continually defend and shill for Donald Trump. They should be trying to get to the bottom of the fact, number one, how successful were the Russians at doing this? And, you know, number two, if they were unsuccessful or if they weren't able to flip votes, are they going to be able to do it as they get more sophisticated in 2018 and 2020? The U.S. system is a total mess, which in this case might work in the favor of not being able to hack it. We don't have like central repositories of election data because we're very decentralized in the way that other countries do. So it is more difficult to hack the U.S. voting rolls. You have to hack it state by state. You have to hack it county by county. But the fact that they tried, to me, is extremely worrisome. And at some point, someone's going to figure out how to do this. And we're not doing anything right now to try to make the system more secure. We have all of these politicians out there talking about how voter fraud is real when it's not, but totally ignoring the fact that we just had a situation where the Russians succeeded in accessing 4/5 of our state's voting rolls. And that should be the problem that we're focusing on.
And it's less about the Russians and more about just an entity.
An entity, yeah. But I mean, everyone's concluded it's the Russians that did it, though. So, I mean, it also, I think it also further solidifies the point that indeed this was the Russians that did this, and not, you know, some other wild conspiracy that some on the far left and some on the far right are alleging.
Ari Berman from The Nation magazine. The piece on Kobach is in the New York Times magazine. We will put a link to it at our blog at majority.fm or our website. I don't know why I keep calling it a blog. Ari, thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
Great to talk to you. Thanks a lot, Sam. Bye-bye. I appreciate it.
Ari Berman, folks. Ari Berman. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break. But I do want to talk about that study. And it really, look, you know, I'm not going to get too granular with it. But it's probably worth just talking about now, because we just had this election in Virginia, a primary election, where Tom Perriello, who was endorsed by Bernie Sanders, he was, you know, every candidate is flawed in some way. And Perriello had some issues, particularly on choice in his past, that I didn't particularly appreciate any more than I appreciated with Tim Kaine, for that matter. But he was one of these guys, and we're going to be talking about this with Kay Sabil Rahman on Friday. One of those guys who spoke the language of antitrust and was, like I say, supported by Bernie Sanders, and was fairly soundly defeated by Northam, who was the lieutenant governor in Virginia. And Northam is the sort of so-called establishment candidate, had much more and deeper and much more long-standing ties with the African-American community in Virginia, and that apparently appears to have been a major part of his win. Every election that we have now, and even ones that we don't have, like in Britain, not our election.
Or France. People,
or France, but France less so. We there is a tendency for people who are advocating for the Democrats to move in a certain direction to really read into it what we want to see. And I think there's not as much that can be gleaned from any of these things as is made out to be. In Virginia, it's unclear. I mean, Tom Perriello, one of the things that people had talked about was that he made a very concerted effort to reach out to the African-American community, where people perceive Bernie Sanders to have done that too late and to continue to have some issues in that regard. Which is not to say that he's just not as well-versed and not as I guess, experienced in developing ties to these communities, you know, from a national perspective. And much of this obviously gets back to where Democrats should go forward. I mean, I think, and I think, you know, people know where I think the Democrats should be headed. But it, you just get into tricky ground where you try and make that argument based on electability. I mean, I think one of the things that Trump has shown is that a lot of these issues don't necessarily define you in the way that we perceive it. For Donald Trump, I think the things that define him, it is the case that he was anti-free trade on the to the extent that one could say that he was anything on the campaign. It is the case that he spoke a language that addressed the situation for a lot of the working class in this country. But there, I just want to, again, reiterate, there was this study, the Voter Study Group. 20 conservative, progressive, and independent academics and professional survey researchers. And the interesting thing about this is that they interviewed people in 2011. And they interviewed the same people now. The main takeaways. While most voters stuck with their parties in last year's election, which, again, we need to remind people about, the vast, overwhelming majority, I don't know if it was 90% or more, who voted for Donald Trump, voted for Mitt Romney, and voted for John McCain to the extent that they were of voting age or alive. White voters who switched from Obama in 2012 to Trump in 2016 were motivated by their views on immigration, blacks, and Muslims, and to a lesser extent by their views of the economy and their own financial circumstances. Trump cobbled together an electoral coalition comprising of voters who hold disparate views on economic issues, according to a study, while Democratic voters agree on most policies. So you have GW, George Washington University professor John Sides, who finds that despite Trump's deviation from GOP or orthodoxy on trade, there wasn't a statistically significant relationship between trade attitudes and vote choice in either election between 2012 and 2016. Trump voters, however, did have a more negative perception of the economy. And that had the same impact on voters' decisions as in 2012. But attitudes that more strongly related to the vote in 2016, immigration, feelings towards black people, and feelings towards Muslims. Among whites who voted for Obama 4 years ago, about a third already held these cultural attitudes that align more with Trump's rhetoric. 37% of white Obama voters had a negative view of Muslims, and 33% said illegal immigrants were mostly a drain on society. The effect amongst all whiters, but it was particularly strong amongst those without a college degree. So in about a little more than a third of white voters who voted for Obama and switched to Trump, they were already there. Just they didn't like Mitt Romney. Or they found Barack Obama did not trigger their racism in the way that Donald Trump talking about reminding people of the so-called evils that these different people represent did. However, there was another paper by Robert Griffin and Roy Tixera, which showed that voters' perception of the economy may have helped Trump push voters towards those cultural views. So there is also a second order, maybe this is a first order, that those who expressed negative economic attitudes in 2012 were more likely to express key negative cultural attitudes in 2016, even taking into account their earlier answer to the same cultural questions. So in 2012 and 2016, you may have thought the economy was doing poorly, but Trump was able to exploit that amongst those people by his rhetoric and bring out their racism. I mean, this is very nuanced stuff. Having a negative perception of the economy does not necessarily mean that you are going to act on a racist impulse. But having a negative perception of the economy and having someone actively out there trying to massage those impulses can be effective, as it was for Trump. White respondents who thought the economy was getting worse in 2012 were more likely in 2016 to say immigration should be made harder, no matter what their answer was to the same question in 2012. I mean, that's fascinating. You could say in 2012, the economy stinks, but I think immigration should remain the same. But by 2016, because of the introduction of Donald Trump reminding you how evil immigration is, if you thought the economy was still bad, you'd be more likely to take it out on immigrants. So, rather illuminating. I don't know how you use that information except to say, you know, something similar, I think, to that that thread by Zach Carter that we talked about the other day. If you substitute right-wing authoritarianism for racism, and really, there's not a huge amount of daylight between those things, right-wing authoritarianism, that you need to provide an answer. You need to acknowledge the problem and provide an answer for what those people are going through. And which is not to say that you're abiding racism and whatnot, but the idea is to win elections. And I would also argue to make America better, to make America great again, if you will. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will play some sound clips of Jeff Sessions yesterday and a rather uncomfortable moment on CNN. And I will actually commend Senator Rand Paul. Yes, in a rare moment of transpartisan generosity.
I bet you'll qualify your praise a little bit.
I might. And we have some footage of this horrible fire in London. Really horrible. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Oh, just a reminder, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you become a member, what you do is you support the free show. You keep this show ticking or clicking or sometimes staticking, whatever it is.
Propagating.
You continue to propagate this show. And as a way of saying thank you, we say, hey, we're going to give you a bonus material every day, except for Thursday and Friday of this week. But we're going to give you a little bit extra on the free show. But every day, except for these 2 days out of the year. And you're like, oh, God, that's too much for me to listen to. Well, some days are like, oh, you know what? I'm a little tired of Sam having his eighth guest on to talk about one tiny facet of Medicare or something. Like, how many times do we need Sam to do an interview on the actuarial tables of people being treated with Medicare? I would say a lot, but I'm not going to judge. If you're one of those people like, I don't need to listen to the 11th one, or I'm going to save that for the beach. So what am I going to listen today? You listen exclusively to the fun half. I know a lot of people do that. That doesn't bother me. I'm offering it up.
That's the one I listen to when I listen to the show, because I usually talk more on the fun half.
Matt just is trying to develop. He's been working on like some type of podcast script where it just seeks out his audio. So maybe that'll be a bonus. Maybe we'll do that at, like, once a year. We'll do a bonus thing where it's just Matt just pulls out his comments.
The Matt Report.
It's all Matt comments. Just little tiny little phrases here and there. But go to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member today. And again, if you cannot, if you don't have the financial means to do so, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will work something out with you. Bear with us. Sometimes it takes us a week, even sometimes more, to check some of these emails, depending on what's going on with everything. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Just a programming note. Well, for non-members, it won't make a difference. You won't even know the difference. So forget it. We're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. Be right back after this.
No, things are looking bad.